Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, live from Shanghai. If you want to hear the sound of American business in China, you can hear it behind me right now. Starbucks, Nanjing Road, Shanghai. Packed. Doing business in China is no cinch. Crazy regulations, unreliable courts, hard to get consumers, and the occasional firestorm over human rights or Tibet. Even so, a lot of American companies smell the coffee. This hour, On Point from Shanghai, U.S. business in China, and the future of U.S.-China economic integration. We have a great crew of American business players joining our conversation here in Shanghai this hour. From Beijing, Mr. Tang Jun, president until 2004 of Microsoft China, in a stretch of super growth for Microsoft's China operations. Until this month, he was president at Shunda Entertainment, a $340 million publicly traded entertainment company in China. Today, he was named president and CEO of New Huadu Industrial Group, a $6 billion Chinese conglomerate with business in retail, mining, real estate, and finance. His pay package estimated at 1 billion Chinese yuan, $140 million, a record in China. Congratulations, Tang Jun. Big day for you. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. This is Tang Jun from Beijing.
Yes, we know, and we're glad to have you. Thanks for being there. With me in our On Point studio, high above Shanghai, is Tom Doctoroff, Northeast Asia Director for JWT, giant U.S.-based advertising and marketing firm. He worked at JWT in Hong Kong from 1994 to 98 and in Shanghai for a decade since then. Clients in China, Ford, Kraft, Nokia, and a whole lot more. He is author of Billions Selling to the New Chinese Consumer. Tom Doctoroff, great to have you right here. Thanks so much for being with us.
Great to be here.
And with us from Boston is Malcolm Riddell, president and founder of the boutique investment bank Riddell Tseng. It specializes in foreign direct investment in Chinese real estate. His clients have included MetLife, Cigna, and Fidelity. He's lived and worked in China and Taiwan for more than 15 years before founding Riddell Tseng in 1988. He was a CIA case officer in China operations. Sounds like a story in that. Malcolm Riddell, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Thank you, Tom. Great to be here.
Let's go right to a piece of tape. Talk about doing business in China. Here is Google's CEO, Eric Schmidt, speaking in Beijing on a visit to China just last month.
First, congratulations to China for now being the largest collection of Internet users in the world, an honor that I think China will have for many years and probably for the rest of my life. So it's a pretty big deal. And second, I want to celebrate the achievements of Google China, the success of our investment, the success of our leadership, with many products to come, which we're very excited about.
There we go. Google, the voice of Google, Eric Schmidt in Beijing last month. Tang Jun, you're in Beijing right now, and now heading up as an American, a giant Chinese company. So what does that tell us? Does it mean if you're not Google or Microsoft where you were, you've got to be a Chinese company to make it big in China?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's in China today, we have a lot of potentials, and it's not only just for American companies, but also for Chinese companies as well.
But why did you go to a Chinese company? If American companies can come to China and do so well, why didn't you stick with one?
Well, you know, the American company always has some of the bandwidth in doing business in China. But if you are a local company and you have a lot of bandwidth to expand your business, not needed to, you know, following the corporate guidance in the U.S., and we can define our own guidance doing business in China, because doing business in China is so different from doing business in the United States. And if you just follow the U.S. corporate guidance, and you have a lot of restrictions in doing business in China.
You grew up in Beijing, you're an American citizen, now you're at the top of this big company. How does it feel to be the highest paid executive and an American in China?
Well, it's nice to have a high pay in China, you know, because in general, the pay in China is very low compared to the U.S. companies in general. But I'm kind of lucky to get such a high pay in the States, so I'm very happy on that.
Does it, you know, in the United States, there's a lot of talk about high-paid executives and the gap between their pay and American workers. How does it feel to be that high-paid in China, where a lot of workers may earn $200 a month?
Well, actually, this day, you know, a lot of media generating a lot of kind of discussions on how much I get paid from the company, and also how much the, you know, the normal workers get paid. There are a lot of gaps between. But, you know, this is a kind of a knowledge economy. It's not only just about how much you get paid, but mostly how much you contributed to the company. That's the definition of the, you know, how you get paid. So I think, according to my past record, obviously I did give the previous company a lot of, you know, increase in the financial returns. So they recruited me and tried to pay me a lot. So
that is a song Americans have learned well. Tom Doktoroff, you're watching all this, watching American companies come in, try to come in, succeed, fail, also working with Chinese companies. What are you seeing these days about who does well and who does not among American companies that head to China?
Well, I think that the basic rule is that I think that what Tang Jun said is right. You cannot assume that what Chinese consumers and what Chinese operating situation is going to be similar to what we would expect in America. We basically assume in the West that there is a civil, I don't want to say civil society, but there is a rule of law, there's an efficient allocation of resources, and that things are very institutionalized. And in China, I think it's fair to say that it hasn't developed to that extent. And so you have to have adaptive ways of coping with inherent ambiguity that exists within the system, or lack thereof.
What do you mean? I can understand what you mean. I mean, rule of law, yes, we expect it. We know China's is not as well established. But how do you do good business without efficient allocation of resources? That's hard for an American mind to take on how you make a profit in that situation.
Well, first, I don't want to say that there's no progress towards efficient allocation of resources.
What do you mean by that phrase?
What I mean by that is that in terms of where investment decisions are made is done based on rational information and transparency.
And they're not in China?
Well, I don't want to say not at all. It's not a black and white thing. Mm-hmm. But I will say that the key fundamental prerequisite of doing business with anyone in China is trust facilitation. Getting people on the same side, knowing that one person is going to help achieve the objective of the other person. And then I think the institutions start to come to work.
So human relationships before what? Before the contract, certainly before in court.
I think that that's a perfect a summary, that before contracts are signed, you know, you really do have to know the person very well, and then Chinese will abide by the contracts. But to get to the contract stage, I do think that you need to really get to know what the person's objectives are in ensuring that there is mutuality and reason for trust. Mm. That's on the environment perspective, but from the consumer perspective, it's a fundamentally different consumer, which is a different topic.
We'll talk about how you get to them. Malcolm Riddell in Boston, we're so glad to have you with us there. You've got a lot of experience here. You know, when Americans think about this, I think, you know, our trade deficit with China has to be very large in their minds. China's boom growth that we've seen for so long now, and whether or not that will actively come back to help the American economy, not just through cheaper goods at Walmart, but through the sale of American products. Are you optimistic, Malcolm, about the picture, I don't know, in the next decade for U.S. business in China? Can they make a dent of the size that will make a dent in that trade imbalance?
I think they can make a dent. How big a dent it's going to be really depends on the American companies. I've said often, when people tell me how they're having foreign companies tell me how much trouble they're having investing and doing business, I said, well, if China is such a hard place to do business, how come the Chinese are making so much money?
Right.
I think the other speakers have really kind of hit on the point that if we are going to make a dent, we have to have managers who are comfortable working in the Chinese environment and working the way the Chinese work, because we're on their turf there, and it's really their way of doing it. Now, saying that, I'm not saying we should encourage corruption or bribe people or these sorts of things, but just as Tom was just saying, the importance of relationships, understanding that to a Chinese, a signed contract is probably the best place to begin the real negotiations on a deal, and just sort of, you know, figure out how they're doing so well and begin and join in the stream with them.
for those of us who aren't in the middle of it, figuring out how they're doing so well is a little tricky sometimes when we see the stock market news. Here it is. I got the Shanghai Daily in my hand. China shares nosedive as panic selling rains down 46% since October. Here's Warren Buffett, no mean analyst of markets, on an October trip last year to China on CCTV about his take on China's stock market.
Your market's been extremely strong over here. So there may be some cheap stocks available, but they're not as cheap as they were a year or 2 years ago. I mean, you've had a great stock market here. And I usually like to buy when people are kind of discouraged about stocks. And now they're getting more encouraged in China, and for good reason. But I'm less likely to find something that's undervalued now than I could have maybe a couple years ago.
Tom Doktoroff with me here in Shanghai. What should Americans make of this stock market? That's a huge, huge drop. They're calling this week, they're talking about Black Monday. Maybe that's newspaper speak, but still, it's way down. Does it matter to the environment for getting into this economy? Does it make it a good time, a bad time?
Well, I think the stock market, again, this goes back to the efficient allocation of resources and fundamental corporate governance issues. It's not based on transparent flow of information. And I think that it's fair to say that the stock market in China is no better or worse than a Mechanese gambling binge at certain points in time.
Wow. Okay, so who knows what's going
well,
on in there?
Well, but again, the institutional transference of information just isn't there.
I'm Tom Ashbrook, live in Shanghai, looking at American business in China. Here's Ford.
精彩生活，重新定义。 福特 S Max.
Does it sound like Ford to you? It is. Ford S Max redefines excitement in your life, makes life exciting. We're talking this hour about American business in China and just where it's going, what it takes to get in, how far it may go, the future of U.S.-China economic ties. We're live from Shanghai, joined from Beijing by Tang Jun. He was former president of Microsoft China until this month, president of Shanda Entertainment, and today named CEO of New Huadu Industrial Group, $6 billion conglomerate, great big piece of work. Grew up in Beijing, got his PhD in computer science at Caltech. Tom Doktoroff joins me in our On Point studio in Shanghai. He's Northeast Asia Director and Greater China CEO for JWT, great big American global advertising and marketing firm. And from Boston, we're joined by Malcolm Riddell, president and founder of the boutique investment bank Riddell Tseng, specializes in foreign direct investment in Chinese real estate. We'll have to talk about that. Tom Doktoroff, that was your ad right there at the top.
Yes,
you're,
it was.
You're marketing straight to Chinese consumers there. Is it any different from marketing to American consumers in a TV ad?
Well, the fundamentals of building brands is the same. I mean, if you do the ABCs, but the question is how you do the ABCs. And I do think that the Chinese consumer and Western consumers, in addition to, of course, the obvious differences in income, have pretty different motivations in terms of what they determine as a success. We in the West are very individualistic. Mm-hmm. Society encourages us to define ourselves independent of society. But in China, although egos are huge and ambitions are gigantic, people crave acknowledgement by society. So you never want to cross the line into rebellion, into overt differentiation. You want to climb up the ladder as opposed to define yourself as your own person.
What do you mean by never crossing the line into rebellion? In your ad message?
Yeah, in your ad message, like for example, Nike, just do it, right? The essence of just do it in the United States is saying, hey, don't worry about what the rules say. You define what you want to do and go for it.
And in China?
It's a little bit closer in. Just do it is really about maximizing your own potential and going for it, but never rebelling against authority.
So it's too individualistic or it's too rebellious against authority. That we get right into political thickets here in a hurry.
Well, that's the big misconception. I mean, this is not about politics. This is about the Chinese, I hate to call it this, but the world view. Chinese people are Confucian, fundamentally Confucian, and they have a hierarchical view of life, and yet they want to climb up a ladder of success within that hierarchy. So the conservatism that you might call this, right, actually is not politically driven, but also is consistent with how Chinese people want to live their life and how they define their aspirations.
Is there something then innately difficult about getting in for American brands born in a culture that was born in revolution?
Well, that's a great question. The answer is if you are not flexible in aligning your message with the Chinese worldview, and you are very religious regarding your brand, then there are difficulties.
But if you don't take on their coloring.
You don't have to abandon what we call in the circles your brand architecture to succeed here, but you do have to adjust it somewhat, and you can't be holier than thou with respect to what your brand means in the West.
Tang Jun, when Microsoft first got into China in the early 90s, it ran into cultural problems. The software was everywhere, but nobody was paying for it. Counterfeit copies were all over the place on the streets for a few dollars. How did Microsoft get out of that box? A lot of American companies may fear something like that.
Well, actually, in the early days, Microsoft had a lot of problems in selling the product because, you know, as you said, on the street, people just pay a couple of RMBs to get the software, you know. So for us, it was very, very difficult to, you know, basically you cannot get nothing from the consumers and even for the corporate users. So we had a very difficult time at the time.
How did you change that? I think plenty of stuff on the streets here, maybe not Microsoft software, but how did you get out of that trap?
Well, if you know, there's no way for Microsoft to change the thing. That's, you know, how the difference from, you know, how people think. Americans always think, you know, if we do something, we can make the change. That when I was the president of the Microsoft China, and the corporate pushed me very hard to say, "Hey, Jun, why don't you, you know, crack down the illegal copies?" You know, it was impossible for American companies to crack down kind of illegal copies by us. You know, we do have the law in China, but the law, basically, there's no way to enforce the law by the individuals or individual companies like us. So the only way is to try to convince the government to get a tougher enforcement, you know, on the crackdown of the illegal copies of that. And the change happened when the president Hu Jintao made a trip to the U.S., probably last year, and talked to the Bill Gates and also the
Redmond,
president.
Washington, all that. Yeah.
Exactly. And lobbied to, the Washington lobbied to the Chinese government, and the government, you know, strengthened, you know, the enforcement of the cracking down the illegal copies. But now it's getting a lot better because the government is doing, you know, enforcing that.
I've read there may have been another turning point as well, which is pretty interesting in the way it intersects with government. Back in 2003, that's when you were president of Microsoft China.
Yes.
Microsoft took a very unusual step, offered China and some other countries at that point, but China, the right to look at the fundamental source code for Windows, the operating system. And to get in there was certain portions of their own software, something you had never done before. I mean, I'm looking here at a piece in Fortune. It says, you know, now when China uses Windows in President Hu's office, or for that matter, in its missile systems, it can install its own cryptography. Do you have to surrender the family jewels? Do you have to let the government into your innermost sanctum in order to get access to this market?
Actually, at the time, you know, the government or the public had a fear about Microsoft, you know, had some kind of a backdoor on the Windows system. So the government or the public required Microsoft to provide the source code of the Windows to the government.
And they were even afraid you might be a secret tool for the U.S. government.
Absolutely. But, you know, the Microsoft had to, you know, adopt the Chinese request. And actually, in the end, we did provide the source code to the Chinese government. You know, the government, I wouldn't think the government looked into the source code, but, you know, try to, you know, get the source code is something government wanted to do, no matter, you know, it's real source code or not the real one. But as long as they get the source code, they feel safe.
Doing what it takes to get into China, imagine what it takes to make Microsoft give up the source code on Windows. Let's take a call from San Francisco. We've got Jeff on the line. Hi, Jeff. You're on the line to Shanghai.
Ni hao ma, and I'm just calling because I think this is a great conversation. I lived in China for 2 years, and I'm interested in two things. I think it's important that a lot of your listeners understand the distinction between doing business in China in terms of Microsoft and other engineering firms and actually having an American product presence in China. In southern China, there are so many, making widgets for washing machines and circuit boards for computers, and that's one thing. But to have an American business presence is very, very different. And I can remember the last time I was in Shanghai, I went to a couple American stores there. I think it was Polo and Ferragamo. And I would go in, and I'm like, hey, this is great. Do you have this in my size? And they're like, no. I'm like, well, do you have it in this size? And I couldn't find much of anything. Their supply was very, very low, and that was really consistent. And I finally talked to
them. Why would that be, Jeff? There's 18 million people in Shanghai. Why wouldn't they stock it to the rafters?
I will tell you, I talked to my friend and I said, you know, here I am. I had a really strong dollar, and I'm like, how come I can't buy anything? And they said, you know, my friend who's in retail said that those stores in China were more about sort of bravado and presence, like, hey, here's a store, we're in China, and really as opposed to selling and making money, it was just simply the fact that we have a presence in China. And I remember when the Gap opened in Hong Kong and you went in there and they barely had anything. There were, they, you know, two or three or four or five shirts, and they just didn't have the supply. I think it was more about simply stating that you had a presence in Asia.
Jeff, it's a great point and an important one, just planting the flag there, but maybe just superficially. Malcolm Riddell in Boston, Jeff raises, first of all, this fundamental point. I mean, when we talk about American business in China, I guess you would say that the overwhelming majority of it has been American outsourcing to China, finding partners in China to make all that stuff that comes back in all those container ships. Are we anywhere near, or will we ever be, a balance where that kind of American business, getting it made in China and brought back home, is equaled by product presence, by, you know, American companies really on the ground, whether products or services, but doing it and selling it in China? Can you imagine that, Malcolm?
Yeah, I can imagine it more probably in the service sector. The problem you run into in the service sector is that the Chinese had before the revolution and before 1949, the economy in certain segments was completely dominated by foreigners. And they're trying to avoid that happening again. So
we're sitting in Shanghai that was divvied up, as you know, of course, between French and German and Japanese and right on down the line.
And the Chinese have a long memory about these things. So the answer to your question is more how much the Chinese government lets off the throttle and lets the foreign companies in there to do what they can do. Now, we've seen in life insurance, for example, companies doing tremendously well, but still only having a small share of the market so far. And even to get in there, being required to do it with a joint venture, 50-50 joint venture with a Chinese company. So there's lots of restrictions. And I think if these restrictions begin to ease and the Chinese government feels more confident in its ability to control the key segments of the economy, that you could see a great widening of foreign businesses in those areas and the reduction of the trade surplus that you're talking about.
Tom Doctoroff, we've read that a lot of the formal restrictions have been diminished. You tell us, I'm not sure, but that, you know, it's still just kind of such an unfamiliar tangle for companies. Is China technically, formally, legally open, wide open to American business, or is there still a fence up?
No, there are fences here and there, but compared to 10 years ago, you know, the openness of the market, it's like night and day. That's point one. Point two is that there is a middle class here with disposable income that has critical mass at this point. So whether you're talking about automobiles, whether you're talking about shampoo or athletic shoes, a lot of the leaders in the market are foreign brands, some of which are American. So there is a lot of non-strategic product categories being sold and dominating the market.
Name some American brands in that category that are not tokens, as our caller Jeff and
General Motors. General Motors has a million vehicles sold every year. And
made in China? Made in the USA?
Made in China. Mostly made in China, except for a few imports. Ford has just crossed the $250,000 threshold in terms of vehicles per year. I'd like to say also that the Chinese consumer has an active preference for international brands because they trust the quality and the cool of those international brands, and they command a price premium. So the secret of achieving critical mass is to be able to also charge a price premium.
What about that foreign brand when it comes to a time of political tension like we've been in just the last month? A lot of Chinese nationalism stirred up by criticism over Tibet. I've seen a lot in the papers this week here of sort of angry commentary from the government and more widely about the United States, Nancy Pelosi and all the rest. Does that hurt American brands in China? Is there...
It'll last for a month. Chinese people are very pragmatic. They want to buy the best product, and they want to buy the product that has the best effect on their image. So, of course, if a company, a specific company, is seen as arrogant, for example, Procter & Gamble had a big SK-II public relations disaster. I don't want to get into the details of that.
SK-II?
It's a cosmetic. It's, okay. It's a face cream. And they handled the accusations of some tainted ingredients mm-hmm. in not such a skillful way. That, I think, because it was very specific and the company was perceived as arrogant and not respecting the feelings of the Chinese, that probably had an impact of several months. But in general, there is a trust of foreign Western brands and American brands as well.
But how bad is it right now? Have you told your clients to just pull their ads in the last month because things got so hot here, or no way, just pedal to the metal?
Nope, pedal to the metal. It's not having a big impact at this point. People are capable of separating politics from what they need to get on with their lives.
Let's go to Steve, calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Steve, you're on the line to Shanghai. Good to have you. What do you see?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling because whenever you start to market in a foreign language, in a new foreign language, there's often funny stories associated with that. And classic examples are like, you know, trying to sell Nova cars in Mexico, and even where you're from locally, Osco drugs in New England is pretty funny to some people. So there's got to be some funny stories in China with all these new companies there, and I'm wondering what they might be.
Nova in Mexico, that's an old chestnut, but how about it? Tom, this is in your neck of the woods.
Well, I think it's actually in Tong Jin's neck of the wood, too. I think one of the funniest cases is Google, because Google's brand name in Chinese is Google, and that literally translates into Valley Song. Google in the West, which isn't exactly new style, but right. Google in the West is the personification of new generation infinite discovery.
Hipper than hip.
Hipper than hip. And then in China, what do they do? They go into the Valley Song. So Baidu and you know its competitor here just made hash of that whole thing and made a huge ad campaign about how the foreigners just don't understand. But in general, things have gotten much better, and most of the advertising agencies are led by local people that have a very good understanding of the Chinese language, particularly on the creative side.
So, Tang Juin, have you had problem situations, funny situations with your high-tech products when it comes to language, or do you somehow escape that?
Well, actually, when we were at Microsoft, you know, we tried to translate some of the Microsoft product into Chinese, and we realized it's very difficult to translate it into Chinese. In the end, we decided to use just English as the product name, and probably it's a safe to do, you know, better than in the translating into Chinese way.
Because every time you do that, it ends up sounding like some literal
Chinese word
that you may not intend.
Absolutely. You know, sounds like a funny, like a Google, you know, the like a Valley Song.
Valley Song. Funny. Suddenly it's something goofy. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, live from Shanghai, China. We're talking this hour about American business in China and the future of U.S.-China economic ties. My guests from Beijing, Tang Juin. He was president of Microsoft China 2002 to 2004. He was just named today CEO of a $600 billion conglomerate here in China, New Huadu Industrial Group. They're into all kinds of things, retail, mining, real estate, finance, tourism, you name it. The biggest pay package ever, $1 billion Chinese yuan, 140 million dollars being reported for Tang Jun. With me in the studio in Shanghai, Tom Doktoroff. He's Northeast Asia Director and Greater China CEO for JWT, the great big marketing and advertising firm out of the U.S. Big Chinese clients and big American clients here. He's author of the book, Billions, Selling to the New Chinese Consumer. And with us from Boston, Malcolm Riddell. He started out in China in the CIA, got into all kinds of business here. He's president and founder of the boutique investment bank Riddell Tseng. They bring foreign direct investment into real estate in China. I've got a question, Malcolm, for you. Law firms, for example, you talked about services as being a big opportunity here, but what does that actually mean? There was, back in the day, American law firms here would have had a lot of Americans in them, but now there are so many Chinese who have come back from the States, fluent in English, know American law and international law. I think a lot of those firms are staffed pretty heavily now by Chinese. So is it just the nameplate and the guy in the or gal in the corner office, or more than that?
No, I think the Chinese that have come back are making tremendous contributions to the development of the legal system in China as lawyers in these firms. But don't forget that the foreigners who are in there, most of the ones I know, are really old China hands. I was having lunch the other day with one of my friends who'd graduated from Peking University with a master's in law, did the whole thing in Chinese, been here 20 years. So I think there's an integration. At the best law firms, there's an integration between the senior lawyers from the West and the Chinese lawyers. And also remember, the Chinese lawyers are very often trained at the firms in the U.S., so they're really pretty international players.
Tom Doktoroff, in your own firm, JWT China, what's the percentage of American staffers?
American staffers is 1%, and that's me. 95% are mainland Chinese, and about 50% of our senior management is local, and 50% is either European or more dominantly expat Chinese, not as we call them, ABCs.
Overseas Chinese.
No, Hong Kong and Taiwan and Singapore.
Mm-hmm. But is that the way it has to be or should be to be successful?
Well, we are facing, in the advertising industry, which is all about leadership, new ideas, creativity, challenging convention, we are facing a leadership issue. And I think
What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that Chinese people very much respect careers that are concrete and solid, you know, owning your own business. But in the advertising world, you have to feel comfortable
too gauzy
with the
high concept.
You're denigrating my life.
but is that their perception?
It's a little bit too abstract. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's a little bit you can't put your hands around it. So a lot of the senior level people, mm-hmm. you know, are ones that can challenge a convention and ones that can you know have the courage to persuade and articulate the abstract. And these are people that tend to be from different cultures. Now that's not to say it has to be like that. For example, in our Beijing office, we have a local managing director, you know, from mm-hmm. from Beijing. But in general, the leadership as a persuasion is something that is much more developed in the West.
Tang Jun, what about it when it comes to high tech? I mean, when you were with Microsoft, and when you look at Microsoft now, I assume most of their staff in China is Chinese. But what does that mean? Is it selling Microsoft products to China, or is it now doing research and development to sell back into the United States?
Well, actually, you know, Microsoft probably is one of the best companies in China doing kind of art research and development in China and sending this product back to the United States and get a lot of, you know, the popularity in China as well. And in terms of the staff members, and also Microsoft probably is doing the best in localization of the staff in China.
Let's hear from your former big boss, Microsoft Chairman Bill Gates, on this exactly this front. Here he is speaking at Peking University in April last year.
The innovation here is really on a very rapid pace. More and more people to recognize the incredible capabilities. China will be a leader in these contributions. That's already, of course, the case for the hardware piece, but it's becoming more and more true for the software piece as well.
Tang Jun in Beijing, if that's the case, that really means moving Microsoft R&D to China. That make for global efficiencies. But is that good for the U.S. economy? It may not sound so good to U.S. software engineers.
Well, I think, you know, today's economy is more like a global economy. And as long as you can, you know, doing an efficient way, you know, for example, developing software in China with a lower cost and a higher quality. And I think it's also beneficial to the U.S. economy as well, you know.
Because that sometimes sounds like the point at which we know the globalized economy has brought a lot of benefits, but it sounds like the point at which Americans end up feeling like losers because those high-paid jobs go away, and the talk about, you know, American business in China looks more like a net loss than a net gain to a lot of potential Microsoft and other employees, maybe.
But it's very different. You know, in the high-tech area, it's very different. Think about it. If you can develop high-quality with low-cost product in China and back to the United States, and the United States can, you know, export this product to the other countries, you know, the European, Japanese, mm-hmm. and other, the countries. And so the beneficiary is Microsoft, also is the United States. So China probably is only one exception of the, you know, kind of a beneficiary.
Yeah, we take your point. Let's take a call from Somerville, Massachusetts. We've got Tim. Tim, you're on the line to Shanghai.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
My question is, you see a lot in America now in the advertising for green products, hybrid cars, and mm-hmm. the like, and you hearing more and more about the triple bottom line for the business model of economic, social, and environmental. Rather than just economic bottom line. I'm wondering if any of that is transferring over into the China business models and, you know, if they're considering the environmental costs for this progress.
That's a great question. Terrible environmental damage in China, and we will talk about that this week. I mean, really catastrophic damage in some areas. First, Tom Doktoroff, on the marketing and product design front, does green matter in China? Are Chinese consumers, 1.3 billion or the 300 million middle class, are they attracted to a green product?
Well, green as a value, it does not have a lot of resonance. But green, environmental friendly, as a means to an end, that is a way of continuing the smooth progress into the future, is important. And the key thing is well, we Americans respond to values. In China, they want to see a result. They want to see a pragmatic impact that is going to make their life better.
What if they're told that the overall global environment will be healthier because of...
It's not going to sink.
What's it got to be then?
It's got to be
clean my
in
floor?
China. No, it doesn't have to be clean my floor. it has to be that your future is not going to be threatened by something that's environmentally unfriendly. Mm-hmm. So when it talks to the air that you breathe mm-hmm. and the child's lungs, all right, mm-hmm. that will have impact. When it comes to sustainable economic growth, which will benefit your immediate family and the entire nation, that will be relevant. But again, it can't be a, as you put it earlier, a gauzy value. It needs to hit home and it needs to be relevant to people's desire to move forward in their lives.
Do you think China will be a leader in green products or a lagging market?
Well, I personally think that, you know, Chinese people are extremely pragmatic and realistic about the challenges that they face. And so I do believe that there's going to have to be innovation on the green front because of what you said before, the degradation environmentally is so severe that there is a short-term crisis that's going on.
Let's take a call from New York City and Matt. Hi, Matt. You're on the air to Shanghai. What do you think?
Well, I wanted to comment again on the car. I did some research on a preliminary report one time. I do marketing for a living. And it said something along the lines that in China, when somebody goes to purchase a car, it's a completely different situation from when an American purchases a car. And I was wondering if you might have some opinions on to what the difference is in terms of how they symbolize value.
It sounds like we're in the right place for that. Tom Doktoroff has worked on exactly that, and a lot of cars are being sold in this country, something like 1,000 new cars a day hitting the road in Beijing, I think. The process that they go through to buy it and the... What they're looking for in terms of, I don't know.
Well, the process is just a little bit difficult because in Shanghai, for example, there's a license plate tax, which is very expensive. But, okay, in terms of what they're looking for, a car has quickly become a rite of middle class passage. You cannot be a real man and a real player in society until you have a house, a car, a wife, and then a child. So
and your wife wants that car too.
The wife wants the car too. So that's one thing is that they're much more of an imperative from a perspective of identity than they are. Much more, not as functional as we say. And then the second thing, it's all about advancement in life. It's all about a means to success.
So I've made it to here.
Your status. Mm-hmm. Sports cars in China still haven't made it. All right. So even BMW, which in the West is sold as a driving machine, mm-hmm. you feel the excitement going through your body. In China, it's a luxury car, and it's made to impress with a big back seat so that you can be chauffeured around. Now, of course, you want to have some of those driving values in there, but ultimately, it's about a man's journey towards success. And a lot of the advertising...
I saw a little convertible BMW on the roads of Shanghai. Just today, though, there are some out there.
I would encourage you to look at the ads and how they're positioned. It's not mm-hmm. positioned as a zoom, zoom thrill.
Mm-hmm. Let's get a call from Columbia, South Carolina, and Linda. Hi, Linda. You're on the air.
Hi, yes. We have a daughter who's finishing a second year in college. And yeah. When she went to college, we encouraged her to switch from Spanish to Chinese. And yep. My question to you is... Is she sticking open doors for her? Was that a smart move?
We'll pick it straight up. Malcolm Riddell, how about it? You know, all over the United States, kids are getting this message. China has got big-time economic growth going on and a whole lot more to come. Learn Chinese, and you can click into that boom, that future. Does it really work that way, Malcolm?
You know, it does today. When I first started off doing China things 20 or 30 years ago, there were very few foreigners who spoke Chinese, and the real emphasis was on functional capabilities and what you could bring to a job. Today, the level of Chinese among foreigners, young foreigners, is so high that without it, I think you're really not competitive if you want to work in the China market.
And if you've got it, if you come in fluent in Chinese... And maybe that's even your major, or what should you major alongside that in to have job opportunities here? What kind of Chinese-speaking American 20-somethings are going to be hired in China?
Here's the way I look at it. If you get your language skill down and also cultural skills, one of the things I've also seen is the young people with really good Chinese don't necessarily have a feel for the Chinese society and Chinese people. They can talk to them, but there's sort of like there's a little gap between in the understanding. Beyond that, I think you get a strong functional background. I talk to lots of people who want to get MBAs and go to, say, international MBA schools. But
right.
in my view, you go to the best MBA program you can get into, whether it has anything to do with China, international, or whatever, and then... go to the into the industry you want to, get your functional skills, end up in China. So you've got the best combination. You understand the culture, the language, and on top of that, you've got strong Western functional skills that you can bring there, make a contribution to your company, make a contribution to China, and you'll be more appreciated.
Linda, I hope there's some good advice for you and your daughter right there. Let's take a call from Torrington, Connecticut. And Lewis, you're on the air, you're on the line to Shanghai.
Thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Yeah.
I have a question, I guess, see what everyone thinks about this. I was wondering how long you think it'll take for Chinese consumers to be at some type of a level, maybe similar or comparable to, like, American and European consumers, and how long will it take for the market to be able to develop to that level? I guess, I mean, in terms of, like, discretion, awareness, and also, like, in terms of the domestic market in China, because I think that it's, I mean, I've been to China before, and it doesn't seem like it's nearly as developed as, say, American or European market, and I think that's probably in part due to the, consumers, because it's a...
Right. Lewis, our time is short, but let us look at exactly that, and let me play something here. You're on exactly the same wavelength, in a way, as U.S. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson. He was in China this month, the Academy of Sciences, talking about a big difference between the economic realities of the U.S. and China.
Long-term structural challenges confront both of our economies. For the United States, the challenge is to save more and spend less. For China, the challenge is to save less and consume more.
Tang Jun in Beijing, will the Chinese do it? You hear Lewis asking from Connecticut, you know, if you come to China, yes, you've got a middle class now and some very rich, but you've got a lot of poor people here too. Will China ever become the kind of society that will really be consuming stuff that Americans and others make and services they have to sell on a fully developed scale? Lewis asks, like the U.S. or Europe?
Well, I think it would probably take at least like 30 years for Chinese consumers to catch up to the level of today in the U.S. and Western, you know, European countries. So I think if you look at the average, you know, the income is like a 22,000, you know, U.S. dollars compared to, you know, it's probably one-tenth of the U.S. income in average. So I think it from my perspective, I think it probably takes 30 years or, you know, even longer to match the current level in the United States.
30 years is a long time. Tom Doktoroff right here with me in Shanghai. That's long enough for the U.S. to kind of lose the race and be out of it. Can both these countries be winners when it comes to business?
Absolutely. I think that the fundamental competitive differences, competitive advantages are very different. The United States is a innovation-based economy. China is a production-based economy. And I think that they can coexist. It's a yin-yang proposition. And I think that if we understand each other's culture, there can be a, as the government likes to say, a harmonious 21st century.
Well, there's a good line to go out on. That we heard Bill Gates say, though, China's becoming much more innovative all the time. Pull your socks up, America. Learn your Chinese. Tom Doktoroff with me in Shanghai with JWT China, CEO there. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Malcolm Riddell in Boston with Riddell Tseng. Malcolm, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Tang Juin, congratulations again on your big job. A new Huadu Industrial Group, thanks for being here.
Thank you very much.
Listeners, check out their website, onpointradio.com/China. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.